Christian Cosmology and Alternative Christian Cosmology 101. And we started yesterday by, I drew a picture of kind of the Babylonian static cosmology of the universe with the dome, heaven and hell, the neat hierarchy on the earth, the stage. And then we drew this alternative cosmology, which I think is an older one. It's because I think this one goes back to the Exodus experience, while the other cosmology would be a more recent one that would maybe come more out of the time of the kings, learn from the Babylonians during the Babylonian captivity. And tonight we're going to look at how Jesus really lived this kind of a dream. Some of you talked to me after last night and were like having more loops. So I added loops. Robert, were you kind of...
Well, circles. But loops will do.
Loops are closer to your circles.
Yeah.
Just want to make everybody happy. And maybe, I think you would probably even like one that would go more... Maybe.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes, I like that. Yeah.
I'd like to mention before Vespers tonight, some gathered here to listen to the Marty Haugen Holy Communion liturgy that I think is used fairly frequently at Holden here. And we're hoping by summer and into fall that it will finally be published, and it will be published by GIA, and we're kind of putting together the last parts of it now. And I think one interesting thing about this liturgy is that Marty Haugen told me that the inspiration for the liturgy came from the study up here at Holden of Ephesians, of the dream of God, the vision of God, the plan of God to unite all things, things in heaven and things on earth, to unite everything in creation. And when you hear that liturgy, you can just hear that theme running through. It's really a liturgy of this cosmology. All through that Holy Communion is the dream and the vision of God's future. And how then the Holy Communion really becomes a celebration of that future. And I think the most living way to look at the Eucharist of the Church is to look at the Eucharist as a drama of God's future that we get to share in the present. That everything that is promised of the way the world will be is now presented to us as we do the drama of the Holy Communion. There is abundant bread for all, and no one hoards any of the bread. The bread is shared by all, and there isn't even a big wafer for the fancy people and a little wafer for the other people. We portray the way the world will be when the day of Shalom comes, the day which we dream about and we wait for. And with all creation and all the animals and the trees, the sky, the birds, the mountains, the planets, the stars, and the quarks, whatever that is. We join all of them in the longing for this day. And so the Holy Communion at its best becomes a feast of longing and expectation. That's why we sing, may this be a foretaste, may this be an appetizer of the feast that is to come. Now, I want to look at Jesus as in relation to this cosmology tonight. So we're only going to talk about Jesus tonight. I had a talk with David Wald, our bishop, the other day, and we just started talking. What if a congregation decided to talk nothing for 2 months except about Jesus? And all you could talk about for 2 months in a congregation at all the committee meetings and church councils was just talking about Jesus. And what was Jesus like? What did Jesus do? What did Jesus teach? How did Jesus live? And so at least for tonight, for these moments to reflect on Jesus. And the first thing I would just share is how Jesus was future-oriented. The reign of God, or often the old translations, the kingdom of God, was the coming messianic age that Jesus announced is now here and it is arriving in my coming. It is the banquet feast of the reign of God. And then notice how Jesus' stories and parables fit into this, something that is growing and emerging and becoming. The reign of God is like a seed that is growing. The reign of God is like a plant or a tree that's growing towards maturity. The reign of God is something that is coming and it is present, and yet we are waiting for it to be fulfilled. At the time of Jesus, there were two characteristics that people believed would come when the Messianic age comes. This comes from Jeremiah's. One, they believed there would be abundant food, and the other, they believed there would be abundant mercy. So Jesus didn't disagree with that. The only disagreement was for whom. Because his country people believed there would be abundant mercy and abundant food for some. And the difference that Jesus had would be it would be for all. Now, probably Jesus' future orientation and Jesus' dreaming in no place is more plain than in the prayer that Jesus taught his disciples. And the importance of that prayer would be in this little story. That at the time of Jesus, every rabbi or teacher was expected to come up with a short prayer. And this short prayer would be taught to this teacher's disciples, a way of summarizing all of the teachings into one succinct prayer. It's just a custom. If you were a respectable rabbi, that's what you did. And when the disciples came and said to Jesus, teach us to pray as John taught his disciples to pray, you notice what they were probably really asking. John the Baptist has come up with his. When are you going to come up with yours? You get it? So then Jesus says, and he taught them to pray. And then in the Lucan version, Father, hallowed be your name. Your kingdom come. Our bread for tomorrow give us today. Forgive us our debts as we forgive those in debt to us. And save us from the time of trial. Now, the future orientation is clear in the cry of Jesus' prayer, which now summarizes the entire teaching of Jesus, is this aching and longing and pleading for the coming of the reign of God. And then it prays that reign of God may be here in our present life. As Jesus calls us to pray, give us our bread today. And the correct translation is give us tomorrow's bread today, which has both the sense of daily bread and also the bread of the final shalom, the bread-sharing society, the bread-sharing community of the final shalom. May that be brought back into our present, and may that be experienced today. And the forgiveness, the abundant mercy of the final shalom, may that be known among us today. Jesus was one who longed for that future. And then to join the movement of Jesus, or the Jesus movement, is also to long for this future, to ache for it, to hope for it, to believe in its coming, and then to do this in the present of to believe so firmly that it is coming that you just kind of pretend like it's already happening. You say, why not just do it? Why not just pretend like the powers of the world really aren't in control, since they really aren't anyway? Why not just go living as if death is not reigning on this earth? Why not live that future in the present? And so Jesus calls disciples around him and says, let us live the future of God now. And it is here that Jesus becomes a political threat. Because a group of people that are living as if the people who think they are running the world aren't really running the world. And this group of people decides to live anyway, the way that will be in the reign of God, become a political threat. I was touched when we were in El Salvador by being at the Faith and Hope Refugee Center. Does that still exist?
It's not a refugee center, it's an orphanage.
It's an orphanage now. Yeah. But I remember being there and hearing from the people and saying, we will just live our lives in this refugee center the way El Salvador will be when it is free. Why wait? You know, so there in that place, bread was shared by all. All had enough. And there was joy abundant that was shared by all. There was mercy in that place. There was dignity for everyone. And there was a sense that no one could come into this little compound without having a sense of worth and dignity. Let's live it as if it is happening now. And this was the Jesus movement. And I think it is also why it was a political threat. What I'd like to share is some help I got on this, and then I want to pull you in to work with me. Help I got on this from a New Testament scholar whose name is Marcus Borg. Has anybody heard Marcus Borg or know of Marcus Borg? So I get to introduce you to Marcus Borg. Okay. Marcus Borg does not teach at one of the great theological centers of the world, New Testament. He is the religion professor at Oregon State in Corvallis. And a wonderful teacher. I think he's been voted several times, kind of some of these schools vote what the most popular teacher or the teacher of the students. I mean, he is just one of those rare teachers who is actually interesting. All I knew of Marcus Borg before was that he was the head of this national group of New Testament scholars that had an annual convention where they hold up their colored cards. Anybody heard of this? They vote on whether or not Jesus said something or not. You know, they read a passage. You've read about this in the press. You know, they read a passage from the words of Jesus, and then they all hold up their color cards and vote on whether or not Jesus really said it. And so at least you get kind of the current opinion of a wide range of New Testament scholars over whether or not Jesus said something or the early church said Jesus said something. So when I heard Marcus Borg, this was my only background of this person must be a real, is it iconoclast? Would that be kind of a right word to kind of free with the tradition? And then, to add to suspicion about him, the lectures he was giving on Jesus were being held at the center of atheism in Tacoma, which is UPS, the other college, formerly Methodist, but having thrown off the shackles of the church, you know, and is kind of the L place in Tacoma. So here, Marcus Borg is lecturing, and went there and found him to be a passionate man of faith, a passionate man deeply committed to his faith in Jesus Christ, and also a person of the church who loves the church. It's one of those surprises. You know, my first surprise was when he got up to lecture, he said, "Let us pray." Anyway, he described to us now the context into which Jesus came, and it was a context that lived a politics of division. And certain elites thrived on a politics of division. And Jesus, with the dream of God's future unity, came into that society with a politics of unity. But first, he explained what kind of culture this was. Intellectually, it was a Palestine at the time of Jesus was intellectually was being the pressure was from Hellenistic thinking and Greek philosophy. So you had that pushing in. And then the Roman occupation was pushing on, and these were the Gentiles. You know, if people are hating Gentiles in the New Testament, it is not Gentiles in general. It is the Roman occupation and that Roman brigade or legion, the Roman soldiers that are standing on the street corners with their swords, those are the Gentiles, and you hate them. Also, what they did to the ordinary people in their collaboration with the Jewish elites in setting up a tax system, so the small landowners, or as we learned in Winter Soldier, not landowners, but Nahala keepers. Do you know what I mean by that? Nahala was your inheritance, and the spirituality was you never owned it, it was God's. And you held it throughout all the generations because this was God's way of providing for your family. And then on this Nahala would be extra crops that were grown that were always meant to share with those who had not enough, because then that was God's manna flowing to them. So families had small plots of Nahala, and then the Roman occupation enforced a taxation system, so you lost it. And then it was taken over by large landowners. So you not only hated the Romans for their occupation, you hated the Romans for the way they had sided with the wealthy of the land. So most of the small Nahala holders had lost their Nahala. Once I learn a Hebrew word, I just can't stop. You have to start thinking about what it was like to go to work in the morning if you had day labor, if you were lucky enough to have day labor. You had to walk past your Nahala that your family had held through the generations, not belong to an absentee landowner. And you might work it as a tenant farmer or maybe pushed completely off. And you have barely enough to provide bread for your family. This was the situation at the time of Jesus. And they joined Jesus in their dreaming, and we'll get to that later, what their dreams were like. The core value of this society was a politics of purity. Society was divided neatly. It was almost like an apartheid system of division according to your classification of purity. And the understanding was that what God really wanted was to call from all the dirty people of the world, all the impure people, that God would form a people who was pure and therefore could live with God in purity. And so society was organized on how pure you were as a group. And so you had class A, class B, class C, and class D. There were, as Marcus Borg explained it, there are four divisions. But what I'm going to do now, there'll be four divisions under division number one, and then there'll be four divisions, and then the four divisions under number one will be partially true of divisions 2, 3, and 4. Should I repeat that? You got that? Never mind. It'll kind of flow out. But what I'll have is the four great divisions, and the first one mainly is the division of purity code, according to the purity codes. The closer you were to being in the really elite group with the most dignity was your ability to keep like dietary regulations, cleanliness regulations, hand washing regulations, far distance from dead bodies and unclean food regulations. The farther away you could be from those impure things, then you would be in this group that had the most purity. So that would be group A. Then group B would be people, because of just their ordinary life, really tried, but they had, you know, in your daily work, you just couldn't do everything right. To be in group A, you would have to have kind of the financial resources so you could be pure. So group B are people that have rather ordinary jobs and they are looked down upon by group A. But they are also honored because they really try and they can keep most of the purity regulations. The third are the very marginal people, and they are somewhat excluded from the community of Israel, although officially they could be part of most of the functions of the community of Israel. The marginal people would be someone like shepherds, very marginal. How could you keep the Sabbath and keep your sheep? Ever thought of that? So shepherds were looked down upon as being in this kind of third marginal group of purity. And then the fourth group were the sinners and the outcasts. And these would be people like prostitutes, tax collectors had sold their souls to the foreign occupation and therefore were most impure, and also tanners, which everybody needed. You needed tanners, but they would be in the most impure group. Why would that be? Yeah, your dead bodies. You know, you were ritually impure for weeks after touching a dead body. What if you touch them every day as your daily work? So a person that was a tanner had no chance of ever having any dignity or respect in the society you were categorized.
Did they have morticians, anything like that?
I haven't studied all this enough, but I would guess anybody that had anything to do with dead bodies, you know, would be pretty far down on the list. And Marcus Borg explains that this was not a society of personal purity, but rather he puts it that it was a society that practiced a politics of purity. Almost like you'd say a politics of apartheid separates people according to their category, and this was a separation by where you lived in the purity, relation to the purity codes. Okay, the second division now, and you'll see how then the purity codes also relate to this, was the higher level and the lower level was men and women. Now this, Marcus Ward said there was some great places in the Hebrew scriptures that countered this, like Judith and Esther and Ruth, the women heroes that were held up in the tradition. But in the society at the Jesus time, women were very much thought of as second class. I'll just give you some examples. They weren't counted for the 10 that were needed to form a synagogue. They were the subject of prayer at that time. A man, the morning prayer of a man was, God, I thank thee that I was not created a Gentile or a woman. They were not taught the Torah. A woman could not go to school. It was thought that teaching the Torah to a woman was worse than burning the Torah. It would be better to burn the Torah than to teach it to a woman. To teach the Torah to a woman was said to be like teaching obscenity. Women were separated. They had to be veiled if they ever left the house. They could not walk outside of the home without being in the attendance of a male of that household. They were to never talk to a man on the street who was not a member of their immediate family. Women were considered stupid and seductive, and they were given the charge of being more susceptible to the four sins than men: gluttony, eavesdropping, laziness, and jealousy. And then the purity codes fit into that because men were considered more spiritual and therefore more pure, and women, because the cycles of the body and the blood, were considered to be more impure and also more physical. It's also an interesting part of the opinion about Samaritan women was it was believed among people at that time, the folk popular belief is that Samaritan women menstruated from birth, which means they never had a week in their life when they were pure. That's how bad the Samaritan women are. These are called prejudices, you know. We have them in our society. Okay, the third was the distinction between rich and poor. There was no upward mobility or possibility of changing your economic status at that time, or little. And the strong belief from the past was that the wise and the righteous will prosper. And this was a weird thing about it. If you were in the rich group, which you were by birth, you were also considered to be in that group because you were wise and righteous. And then if you were among the poor by birth, you were considered to be in that group because you were undeserving. And what it meant was the poor people of that time lived with the burden that it was their own fault that they were poor. And it was somehow a lack of wisdom and righteousness. And so they would walk out of the house with a sense of no dignity, while the rich had the sense that somehow they had earned this. And I don't be very careful not to say that we're accusing the whole Hebrew tradition. We are talking here about an aberration of the Hebrew tradition, and Jesus, who is there really to restore the very best of Judaism, to reform Judaism and to recreate Israel, and renew Israel. The fourth distinction was Jew and Gentile. The Gentiles were totally unclean, impure, headed for destruction, meant only for hell. And also, that was on a spiritual sense, but on an actual political sense, the dream of the populace of that time was when the great holy war comes and we can just start slaying Gentiles. And there would be nothing more beautiful as a person of faith in God than when that moment comes when I can join God in the slaughter of the Romans. This would be a holy act. Okay, now, each of these comes down on the side of division is good. And now let's just go through each of them, and then I don't have this down in any notes, but let's just think in our own memory. These four distinctions, which is the politics of division and the politics of purity. One is the distinction between the pure and the it's not unpure, is it? I am P-U-R-E. Okay, then the second is men, women. The third is
rich, poor.
Rich, poor. And the fourth is Jew, Gentile. Here comes this rabbi who in his prayer calls people his disciples to call God Abba, which is a way of saying we have total intimacy with God, and what we speak and what we say and how we live is the way God lives and the way God thinks. And now let us think, what kind of political life and life of society does Jesus come in relation to each of these divisions? Let's just go through them and just remember of all of our Sunday school stories and all the stories we learn in our religion classes and New Testament classes and reading the Gospels. What was Jesus up to? Should we just go down there? How's our time? This goes till
quarter minute.
Okay. Let's start with the pure and the impure. What is Jesus? Part of this is in preparation for Holy Week and Good Friday. Could we really go into Good Friday this year and see they had some pretty good reasons? They just didn't mistake Jesus and say, oops, we made a mistake. Was Jesus really a threat to the way things were? No. So let's start with the division of pure and impure. The most impure being what were called the tax collectors and sinners and the prostitutes. What do you remember? I'm not going to write them down. Let's just brainstorm.
He ate with them.
Mm-hmm. He ate with them. I think there's one place in the gospel that even said that he reclined with them, because there's two ways of eating. One was kind of the ordinary meal where you didn't recline, and the other was a festive banquet where you had a pillow and you sprawled out with your feet out to the side like this on the pillow, and then the next person was here and the next person was there. This was a festive banquet, and nothing could be more repulsive than for a rabbi who claims to be speaking for God to be reclining at meal with the utter scum of tax collectors, sinners.
Jesus also broke the laws himself. He gathered food on Sunday, on the Sabbath.
It's almost like he entered into the world of the impure, didn't wash his fingers right, plucked grain, broke the Sabbath, healed on the Sabbath.
Restored the sight of the blind man on the Sabbath.
Restored the blind man on the Sabbath. Yeah. It's kind of a double offense, wasn't it? Not only eating with these people, but also in a way becoming one of them. Jesus saw Zacchaeus up in the tree. Did he say, Zacchaeus, could we talk about your life for a while? He says, I must go to your house. And maybe, remember in the story, the response of the people was, murmur, 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 murmur. Because to invite himself to his home was to eat with Zacchaeus without even talking to Zacchaeus first about shaping up. Well, let's go to the second. I have some notes on these so that let's go to the men and women.
Samaritan woman sort of knocks out four categories.
Some who study John say that John, the Gospel of John, is very intentional with the story, is to kind of knock all four categories in one big story. This woman was practically in every category here. She was impure. She was a woman. We don't know about this, but she was, if a Samaritan would be considered as bad as a Gentile. But if you just focus on this this area here, and my goodness, think. Number one, she's a Samaritan. Number two, she's out on the street without a male companion of her family. And she's there at the well, which is, in tradition, is kind of a place of romance. And there she is. And in a society where a woman is not to talk to a man, and there they're chat, 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 chat. And not only that, Jesus is teaching Torah to her, isn't he? In a way, he is accepting her as an intellectual equal. And the other is Mary and Martha. Jesus sets up a little synagogue in their living room. This is unheard of stuff. And he is accepting them as students and scholars. What would another one be?
But the one without sin, throw the first stone.
And the offering of forgiveness to this woman caught in the act of adultery. And there Jesus is with her. Isn't in the story, isn't she also then alone? And the more I think, the deeper you get into these stories, you realize that Jesus was breaking about twice as many rules as we've ever even heard of.
Mary Magdalene.
Yeah, Mary Magdalene. The perfume, the sensuous washing of his feet with her hair, and allowing this sensuous act to take place in public.
Mary Magdalene. The other that we, this is kind of a carefully guarded secret, it's kind of passed over because I think it's even offensive to most Christians, is that Jesus and his disciples basically did backpacking. I mean, where did they sleep at night and everything? And Luke is very blunt that there were women disciples right along with them. It's one thing to stop and talk to a woman for 10 minutes on the street, but here they are disciples with the male disciples, up and down the hills, up and down the paths. And it's the women who go into the towns that are the women of means and buy the food. And we are, this is getting a little too shocking. And then Jew and Gentile, no, rich and poor. Is what would be an example? Jesus ever in any way insinuate that a poor person was poor because it was their own fault or their own? Think of the dignity for the people who were poor. I'm trying to think of an actual story. Anybody?
Well, that parable about the widow. The only thing she gave was a small coin.
Mm-hmm. The Sermon of the Mount, he says, blessed are the poor.
Blessed are the poor. You know, the folk wisdom would be, blessed are the rich, for they are the wise and the righteous. Blessed are the poor.
Story of Lazarus at the rich man's gate.
Rich man and Lazarus. And notice in Jesus' stories how he takes the people that are considered the scum and holds them up as the example. So he not only lives this way, but he teaches this way, that they're always, there's always like the surprise ending of the story. It's the Samaritan. It's the woman. It's the poor person. It's Lazarus. Then Jew and Gentile. In a society where the dream of everyone was to start the holy war and start slaying these inhuman people who God only once killed anyway, so when can we start helping God with God's program? And how does Jesus relate to Gentiles? Is there a story?
Doesn't he cure the daughter of the Roman centurion?
The Gentile woman who comes and begs for healing, and they have this little rabbinic dialogue, you know, about the dogs eating the crumbs that fall off the master's table. This was rabbinic school bantering that you only did with an intellectual equal. And here Jesus is Gentile woman. He raises her up to the level of a student in rabbinic school. And has, if you read what are the novels by the Potter? The novels, you get a picture of the Hasidic way that they, the kind of recreational arguing over the Torah. And Jesus chooses to do this with a Gentile woman. This is great stuff. And maybe the most shocking at all is, what did Jesus teach about relating to the Gentiles in terms of violence?
Love your enemies.
Yeah, love your enemies. And these just weren't any old enemies or somebody you don't like. Enemy was Roman occupying soldier. Love them. Do good to them. Forgive them. If one of them forces you to go to 1 mile, which you had to do, that was the law, walk the second mile and start chatting
That's the meaning behind the second mile, is you start chatting. And then a friendship develops with the Gentile Roman soldier. Love your enemies and do good to them. Now, let's ask this question. I mean, all of these are very shocking. Like, Marcus Borg gave more shocking material here than I could He said it was a generation moving towards war. You know, where the kind of group mind develops, and a whole group mind was moving towards that war with the Romans. And to stand in the middle of that and say, try to have a little walk with him and talk with them. One of them slaps you on the cheek, turn the other cheek. Might throw the person off long enough that you can have a little conversation. And surprise. Pinchas Lapide, the Orthodox Jewish New Testament scholar. Interesting category. When he responds to Jesus saying, walk the second mile, he's saying what Jesus is really saying is surprise the Roman soldier with anticipatory grace. It's interesting from an Orthodox Jew. No, Luther never thought of saying that. Surprise the Roman soldier with anticipatory grace. Okay, now, listen. Question. Why did Jesus do all of this? Was he simply a rebel? You know, we have those students at PLU. There are a few. Am I right? You know, a few that just rebel. Anything that, if kind of the school is saying you should be this way, you're the other way. If the administration says this, you think the other. If most people are dressing this way, you dress this way. Is this the same congregation in California, different times? Do you remember Lois Helberg strumming her guitar and we sang he was a rebel? Or hadn't she found that yet?
No, I think so. Wasn't that one of the Antis' songs? What? The Antis, didn't he?
I think so. Oh. He was a rebel, he was a rebel. I forgot, that's all I remember. What was the motivating factor for Jesus to act this way that was so revolutionary for his time?
I would say it was the tradition that he knew. I mean, it's the Hebrew tradition, but it's the one that there that you're talking about, and not the one that the other had been followed, the more Babylonian mythology that had been sort of adopted. It's more the prophetic tradition. So it's nothing new, it's a recapturing of what was already there in the community of Shalom. The Exodus community.
There are probably two factors of living as what you would call a good Jew. In the mind of Israel, which Jesus lived in deeply, deeply, deeply. And that was to live in memory and to live in hope. And that memory and that hope inform the way you live now. And the way you live now is not informed by the society that is around you and what is currently in vogue. And the memory was of ancient Israel in the wilderness. That was the memory. And then the hope was the coming messianic age. And I don't think Jesus was rebelling. He was just naturally doing what a person does who is anticipating God's future. Because God's future is one where there will be forgiveness for everyone. Abundant forgiveness, unconditional grace and unconditional mercy for all. So that ends this one. God's wondrous future is total love and dignity for everyone with no gender distinctions. And there is even a memory in Israel for calling forth a Ruth, for calling forth an Esther, or calling forth a Deborah. This is ancient tradition. This is memory that also informs the future. So there goes that one. And then the memory of the manna in the wilderness, the bread sharing for everyone. God opening God's hands and abundantly sharing with all. You know, and to ever consume more while anybody is in need is sin. And is robbery. But God opens God's hands and satisfies the desire of every living thing. There goes that one. And then coming from the prophet Isaiah, coming from those prophets who dreamed of a day, and going all the way back to the tradition to Abraham, by your seed will all the nations of the earth be blessed. There goes that one. And what Jesus is doing is he is being pulled by God's future. It's like the magnet that is pulling Jesus and informing him, and also the tradition that is pushing him. And that's all I have to say. except to let this be a preparation for Holy Week, for ritually what Holy Week is, a time that we intensely and ritually identify ourselves with Jesus, and just an invitation to let this be a background. Any responses? We have 6 minutes here. Have anything to say about our world? Do we have distinctions of dignity and worth, and who is more worthy and who is less worthy, for a starter? Does this speak to us?
It's kind of like makes me think, I think it was Ed Meese that said, the poor are poor because they want to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's their fault. The few liberation theologians that I've talked to have told me the wonderful liberation that comes to a poor person, like in Central America or Latin America, when all of a sudden the truth dawns, it's not my fault. Would you concur with, is that a...
Most of the people I work with have already come to that, so yeah, I haven't seen
long past
that transition. Yeah. But sure. Yeah.
It's probably, it wasn't in the old days, that was just considered to be kind of your...
Well, the movie tonight, for people who are interested, will show some of that too. Mm-hmm. As people, as the Archbishop starts listening to the poor people for the first time ever, mm-hmm. and the transit and the liberation that comes to them through that.
Mm-hmm. One, a theologian that we had speak at PLU from Costa Rica, I forgot his name, this one. And he told me he was in Guatemala in the mountains in a little church for mass of the indigenous people. Elderly man in his 70s came and he met him at the door and asked this man a question about his opinion about something related to the church. Asked him his opinion, and the man's response was to just break down in tears, and the man wept and wept. You know, and the theologian just put his arm around the man and just held him for his weeping, and finally asked him to share while he is weeping. And he says, I'm 70 years old and no one has ever asked my opinion. All of a sudden, dignity. Unconditional grace, and that's what make, if a story like that makes me exceedingly angry when I hear an old-fashioned Lutheran theologian say that liberation theology is a new works righteousness. I just want to say, open your eyes. Yeah. Got a little emotional. Certainly want to apologize for this. Swedish manners.
You know what I always struggle with? If Jesus' new way of looking at things embraced this unqualified mercy, unlimited mercy, then where does justice come into the picture? Because it seems that somewhere along the line, I mean, is justice by its nature always merciful, according to Jesus, as a way of... I mean, it's the biggest struggle I have, is that, you know, like, you look at, you know, let's name names, Debiasun, or somebody who engineers desk bugs, and... Is there a justice for people who live like that in the world that goes beyond mercy?
Or is God's grant of justice more of a creative justice so that God creates opportunities for people to become worthy of good things happening to them?
Is that our idea of justice, vengeance?
I think in that respect, we can learn also from people in Central America. Some of you may have heard the story of Thomas Borhe, who's the real bad guy, sinister head of Minister of Interior in Nicaragua, at least until the Sandinistas go out. But he was tortured for 9 months during the last stages of the insurrection that overthrew Somoza. And his wife had been raped and killed by the National Guard previous 2 years, sometime before. And he had a black hood on his head, and every day for 9 months his torturer came in and tortured him. This is the only human being that he saw. And somewhere along the year he said, I'm going to have my revenge on you. And the torturer said, you know, how can you possibly have revenge on me? And he said, I'm going to forgive you. And after the insurrection, so the story goes, he ran into this guy on the streets of Managua and somehow knew him. I guess he must have seen him somewhere along the line. The guy turned completely pale, and Borhe went up to him and embraced him. And it was Borhe who argued most forcefully against capital punishment being part of the new Nicaragua, including no reprisals against the National Guard that had conducted this. And he was the one who said, If we do this, you know, at a time when they were deciding this, he said, if we kill them, then what was this revolution for? And as a result of his arguing, they abolished capital punishment, essentially, and set up a system for re-education and so forth for the National Guard. So, I, you know, it's like, if he could do that, maybe there, I don't know that there necessarily are bounds to the mercy and forgiveness as possible. Mm-hmm. I don't know how that would play out with Dabuson or somebody. But.
Do you
Jesus called it heaping burning coals on their heads. If you really want to heap burning coals on their heads, forgive them. They won't know how to handle it. He'll throw them off guard. They'll have something coming at them that they don't know how to handle in all of their understanding of what power is all about. So I mean, it is a form of, it is a very weird and a strange form of justice. And then the whole history of theology in the Christian church, and the whole two kingdoms and all that is how does that work itself out in the ordinary life of a government, and political life, that's where...
I think there's a certain hardness of heart that is peculiar to some of the military in Latin America, in that poetry by Carolyn Forché, when she dines with the general and his wife. I mean, after they have this nice meal, the guy dumps out a bunch of human ears on the table, and then he takes an ear and he puts it in a glass of water and flowers, and he says, quite matter of fact, that he says, as for the rights of you and anyone else, you can tell your people they can go fuck themselves. And he says that so brutally and matter of factly that that attitude, when I read scripture, is addressed by a certain kind of justice too. And Langdon Gilkey, at the end of a book, Message in Existence, says that what is the ultimate, the epitome of mercy? The epitome of mercy is to forgive the most unforgivable person. Mm-hmm. So in that way, there would be no hell, because everyone is forgiven by the ultimately merciful God. I'm not sure I agree with that.
It's one thing to talk about unconditional mercy and the others to bring up examples. Mm-hmm. And then we're all offended. We're all finally offended by it.